Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
This is a dark day in America. We have a rigged court case that should have never been brought, and it should have been brought in another jurisdiction. As you know, we asked for that, and the judge never allows us anything.
Jury deliberations begin today in Donald Trump's hush money and election interference trial. We'll get the latest. Then, for the first time in Mexico's history, the two front runners for president are women.
Look at this graph of homicides under the government of Andrés Manuel López Obrador. It shows the decrease, but it also shows what would have happened if there had not been a change in policy.
We benefit greatly from free and independent participation. The president and Claudia are talking about fraud, so they surely are seeing something.
We'll speak with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Maria Hinojosa, who interviewed both women. Then, America's monster, how the U.S.-backed kidnapping, torture, and murder in Afghanistan.
We want people to know the extent of the war crimes that were carried out by one of the U.S.'s most important allies in Afghanistan. Hundreds, maybe thousands have disappeared. But I also want people to understand why. Why Razak did these things, and why the U.S. military backed him, even knowing that he did them.
We'll speak with New York Times journalist Matthew Akins about U.S. ally Abdul Razak. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The White House said Tuesday Israel's devastating airstrike on a tent camp for displaced Palestinians in Rafah does not cross President Biden's so-called red line in Gaza. Sunday's attack, which set off a fire in the camp, killed 45 Palestinians and injured over 200, mostly women and children. A CNN investigation found Israel attacked the camp using munitions made in the United States by Boeing. White House National Security spokesperson John Kirby was questioned Tuesday by Ed O'Keefe of CBS News.
How does this not violate the red line that the president laid out?
As I said, we don't want to see a major ground operation. We haven't seen that at this point.
How many more charred corpses does he have to see before the president considers a change of policy?
We don't want to see a single more innocent life taken. And I kind of take a little offense at the question. No civilian casualties is the right number of civilian casualties. And this is not something that we've turned a blind eye to, nor has it been something we've ignored or neglected to raise with our Israeli counterparts, including it this weekend as a result of this particular strike. Now, they're investigating it, so let's let them investigate it and see what they come up with.
At the United Nations, Algeria has proposed a new resolution to demand Israel halt its offensive in Rafah. Meanwhile, Mexico has become the latest country to join South Africa's genocide case against Israel. Despite the growing international condemnation, Israel's continuing to attack Gaza. On Tuesday, Palestinian medical officials said at least 21 people were killed in an Israeli air attack on a tent camp in Al-Mawasi, in an area Israel has designated as a humanitarian safe zone. The dead included at least 12 women. Over 60 Palestinians were injured. On the humanitarian front, aid shipments to Gaza by sea have been halted after a new U.S.-made pier broke apart in rough seas. The temporary $320 million pier had only become operational less than 2 weeks ago. It's expected to take at least a week to fix. In other news from the region, former Republican presidential candidate Ambassador Nikki Haley visited Israel Tuesday and was photographed signing an Israeli artillery shell. She wrote the words, "Finish them!" exclamation point. A joint investigation by The Guardian and the Israeli news outlet 972 has revealed Israel's run an almost decade-long secret war against the International Criminal Court in an attempt to derail the court from filing war crimes charges against Israeli officials. The report details how Israel surveilled, hacked, smeared, and threatened top ICC officials, including the current chief prosecutor Karim Khan and his successor Fatou Bensouda. The news outlets report the former head of the Israeli Mossad, Yossi Cohen, personally threatened Yasuda, telling her, quote, "You should help us and let us take care of you. You don't want to be getting into things that could compromise your security or that of your family," unquote. Despite the threats by Israel, the ICC's Karim Khan announced earlier this month he's seeking arrest warrants for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, as well as three Hamas leaders. Another senior official at the State Department has resigned to protest President Biden's policies on Gaza. The official, Stacey Gilbert, served in the State Department's Bureau of Population, Refugees and Migration. The Washington Post reports Gilbert sent an email to staff Tuesday criticizing a recent State Department report that concluded Israel's not obstructing U.S. humanitarian assistance to Gaza. Protests over Israel's war on Gaza continue across the globe. In London, police arrested 40 pro-Palestinian protesters Tuesday night after about 10,000 people rallied to call on Israel to halt its attacks on Rafah. In Mexico City, police fired tear gas at protesters outside the Israeli embassy Tuesday. Meanwhile, in Paris, France's lower house of parliament has suspended a lawmaker for 15 days for holding up a Palestinian flag during a debate on Israel. And in Canada, dozens of faculty at the University of Toronto spoke out Tuesday, a day after school officials sought a court injunction to clear a student pro-Palestinian encampment. Jury deliberations are beginning today in Donald Trump's hush money and election interference trial. During closing arguments Tuesday, prosecutors accused the former president of trying to subvert democracy and, quote, hoodwink the American voter. Meanwhile, Trump's legal team attempted to discredit Trump's former fixer, Michael Cohen, who testified against his former boss. Trump attorney Todd Blanche called Cohen, quote, the greatest liar of all time, the gloat. Prosecutors reminded jurors that the case rests on the documentary evidence and not just on Cohen's testimony. Trump's lawyer, Todd Blanche, also told jurors Trump could go to jail if convicted. This led to Judge Juan Merchan admonishing him for making what the judge called a, quote, outrageous and highly inappropriate remark. Outside the courthouse, the Biden campaign held a press conference featuring two police officers who worked during the January 6th insurrection, as well as actor Robert De Niro, who warned against another Trump presidency.
This is the time to stop him by voting him out once and for all. We don't want to wake up after the election saying, what, again? My God, what the hell have we done? We can't have that happen again.
In other Trump legal news, U.S. District Aileen Cannon, who's hearing Trump's classified files case, has denied a request by prosecutors to place a gag order on Trump to prevent him from attacking law enforcement agents involved in the case. She was appointed by President Trump. In climate news, India's issued a red alert a day after temperatures in New Delhi reached a record 122 degrees Fahrenheit. Meanwhile, in Brazil, the Inter-American Court of Human Rights is holding hearings to determine what legal obligations countries should face for the climate emergency. The hearings come after historic floods in Brazil displaced hundreds of thousands of people and killed over 150. This is Luisa Tuxa of the Tuxa people in northeastern Brazil.
This is the moment we want the Inter-American Court to hear us, hear our cry, hear our call, hear our anguish, feel some of the pain that the indigenous peoples of Brazil have been going through for thousands of years.
In Papua New Guinea, rescue efforts are continuing after a landslide killed as many as 2,000 people. Papua New Guinea's Prime Minister James Marape said the changing climate is devastating his country.
In this year, we had extraordinary rainfall that has caused flooding in river areas, sea level rise in coastal areas, and landslips in few areas. For instance, we almost had the entire South Simbu, that access passage through the Gumini Highway, that was completely cut for almost a month.
Haiti's unelected transitional council has named Gary Kunia to be Haiti's new prime minister just a month after some members of the council picked a different official for the job. Kunia briefly served as Haiti's prime minister over a decade ago, had been working as a development specialist at UNICEF. The transitional council was formed after Ariel Henry agreed to resign as prime minister amidst an uprising by armed groups. In the nation of Georgia, lawmakers have voted to override a presidential veto of a controversial bill that could force many NGOs and media outlets to register as foreign agents. On Tuesday, one opposition lawmaker in Georgia was doused with water while he spoke out against the legislation. The EU has warned passage of the bill could jeopardize Georgia's chances of joining the bloc. Voters in South Africa are casting ballots today in nationwide elections. Polls suggest the ruling African National Congress could lose its majority for the first time since Nelson Mandela was elected in 1994. In election news here in the United States, Texas House Speaker Republican Dade Phelan narrowly won a primary runoff against David Covey, a far-right candidate who was endorsed by Donald Trump and Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton. Meanwhile, Texas Republican Congressmember Tony Gonzalez has declared victory in a primary runoff against gun rights advocate Brandon Herrera, who is nicknamed the AK guy. Gonzalez, who represents Uvalde, Texas, broke with his Republican colleagues last year to support new gun control legislation after the massacre at Robb Elementary School. And the Libertarian Party has picked Chase Oliver to be its presidential nominee after party members turned down appeals from both Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and Donald Trump, who was met by a round of boos and jeers when he addressed the Libertarian Convention on Saturday. Meanwhile, Jill Stein has announced she's won enough delegates to be the Green Party's presidential nominee. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Jury deliberations begin today in Donald Trump's hush money and election interference trial. Trump has been charged with 34 felony counts of falsifying business records in relation to a $130,000 hush money payment that his former lawyer Michael Cohen made to adult film actress Stormy Daniels. The prosecution's argued the payments were part of a wider scheme to illegally influence the 2016 presidential election and prevent Daniels from going public with her claim she had sex with Trump. Trump has denied that any such encounter took place and has dismissed the entire trial as a politicized attack. In a marathon day of closing arguments, Trump's defense lawyer, Todd Blanche, sought to discredit Cohen, calling him, quote, the greatest lawyer of all time, the gloat, and the human embodiment of reasonable doubt. Meanwhile, prosecutor Joshua Steinglass argued the payment scheme amounted to an effort by Trump to, quote, manipulate and defraud voters to pull the wool over their eyes in a coordinated fashion. He also portrayed Cohen as a flawed individual, but one who offered invaluable testimony, backed up by documents. If Trump is found guilty, it'll likely be weeks or months until he's eventually sentenced. The charges carry a maximum of 4 years in prison. In his closing arguments, Trump's lawyer told jurors Trump could go to jail if convicted. This led to the judge admonishing Blanche for making what the judge called a, quote, outrageous and highly inappropriate remark. For more, we're joined by Ron Kuby. He is a criminal defense and civil rights lawyer based here in New York who's closely following all the Trump cases. He's joining us in New York. It's great to have you with us, Ron.
Thank you, Amy.
Why don't you just summarize the closing arguments yesterday and what your assessment of them was?
Summarizing an amazing 8 hours total of argument, not going to be an easy thing to do. Basically, the defense strategy they went on for 2 to 3 hours was to not tell a counter narrative, not explain another reason why all this stuff was done, but just to search for reasonable doubt. Like when we were little kids, we'd look at puzzles and, you know, circle the rabbits that are hidden in the puzzle. And that's kind of what the defense was doing. Michael Cohen's a reasonable doubt. Stormy Daniels is, you know, and all of the discrepancies were reasonable doubts. Unfortunately, as the prosecution sort of indicated in their 5.5-hour marathon, a trial isn't a search for reasonable doubts. Oh, look, I found one. No, it's a search for the truth. And while he could have told the story in 4 hours rather than six, frankly, it was an amazing summation in which every piece of evidence was explained as a part of the entire narrative of Trump criminality. And it was wildly persuasive in a way that summations usually are not. Now, what the jury does with it, with any of it, of course, is impossible to know. Half the time, I don't even know what's going on in the minds of my family, let alone 12 people that I've never met before.
And Ron, I wanted to ask you, what do you think is the impact of either way on the fact that neither the defense nor the prosecution called Alan Weisselberg, the chief financial guy for Trump and the guy at the center of this alleged conspiracy? What impact will that have, you think?
I don't think it's going to have much of an effect at all. Honestly, they have the Weisselberg memo in there. Either side could have called him, neither did. So arguing that they, you know, the defense should have called Weisselberg if he was going to corroborate Trump's account of this is as silly as arguing the opposite. Plus, the jury doesn't know where Weisselberg is. They don't know that he's sitting around in Rikers Island right now in the geriatric wing on his second perjury plea. For all they know, he's dead or out of town or, you know, is lying there with a heart attack. So I don't think it's going to make much difference.
And of the 34 counts that Trump is facing, are there any that you think are more likely to get a guilty verdict than some of the others?
No, because they're all essentially the same conduct. Falsifying business records, which clearly were falsified, Donald Trump causing those business records to be falsified, which I think has been proved, and doing so for the purpose of committing another crime. And let's face it, most people, when they falsify business records, they do it to either get something that they're not allowed to get or to avoid doing something the law requires them to do. Nobody wakes up in the morning and says, you know, should I cook up some bacon and eggs or should I cook up my business records?
Explain the other crime. I wonder if you polled people in this country, if they understood what he is being tried for, would they really know?
They wouldn't. And in fact, the defense didn't fully find out until a few days ago. There are three other crimes that, and the jury doesn't have to agree. One, New York state law election interference. That is, the machinations of Trump and Cohen and Daniels constituted interference or conspiracy under New York state election law. Two, federal election law, even though there's no jurisdiction to prosecute federal law, and the feds decided not to prosecute Trump for this, cases in New York have held that if you're covering up your business records or falsifying business records to conceal a federal crime, you can be prosecuted. Usually it's a federal tax crime. And the third is state tax crime. That is, I don't know if people were paying attention, but Michael Cohen's quote unquote legal fee was grossed up. That is, they paid him double what he was owed because he had to pay taxes on the money that he got from Trump to reimburse him for the Stormy Daniels payout. And ordinarily, when I collect a legal fee, if I'm charging a client $10,000, I don't say, you know, better make it $20,000 because I have to pay taxes on that. I pay taxes out of the money that I get, like everybody else. So three potential crimes.
And the proof that this involved the election and not just wanting to hurt his wife Melania and his family for having had an affair with Stormy Daniels is that the sex attacks allegedly happened in 2006, and they're paying her off less than 2 weeks before the election, 10 years later in 2016.
Right after the Access Hollywood tape came out, where he made his assaultive and crude comments, and people thought that he might be doomed from that. If he cared about Melania, the argument goes, and Steinglass made this yesterday, he would have paid her off in 2006, 2007.
And Ron, what do you sense would be the political ramifications of either way if the case goes, whether Trump is convicted or acquitted?
Well, now you're talking outside of my area of expertise, Juan. I will say, from the people I've spoken to, the people who support Trump are absolutely undeterred by the potential conviction. It's a rigged trial. It's a phony trial. It's Biden weaponization, blah, 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 all the same stuff that Trump has emphasized over and over again. Whether it's going to be a conviction would be enough to peel away some voters, I have no idea.
So finally, on a different note, you represent many protesters, those who are protesting around Gaza, students from City College to Purchase, to Fordham, and also the climate protesters from outside Citibank to the Westminster Dog Show last week.
Right. And most of those cases have gone fairly well. The Purchase students have had their charges dismissed. The Fordham students are getting their charges dismissed. A lot of the City College students, though, are facing some felony charges, and I've got some of those cases. And Extinction Rebellion did a fantastic protest at the Westminster Dog Show with their usual, you know, no dog shows on a dead planet banner that disrupted things. We're in court on that on Friday, and it is indeed going to be a rough case. But I will continue to work pro
bono.
There you go, Amy.
Such a dogged attorney.
Oh.
Now, wait, I want to ask about City College in particular,
yeah,
because they're facing serious charges, and many make the accusation it's the most diverse college. What are they facing? City College.
It's unclear right now because the charges mostly went in as felonies. And right now, the Manhattan DA's office is reviewing these cases sort of one by one to see whether they're going to indict people or offer people plea to a misdemeanor or lesser charges. The most serious one that I'm familiar with is one I'm handling, where a 21-year-old woman who was literally doing nothing was grabbed off the sidewalk by a member of the NYPD Legal Bureau, who has a long history of misconduct, and was grabbed, thrown down, and he's now claiming she assaulted him because he hurt his hands on her wristwatch. It's one of the sort of old, yes, the defendant hurt my foot by repeatedly striking my shoe with his head kind of cases. Yeah.
Well, we'll continue to follow this. Ron Kuby, criminal defense and civil rights lawyer based here in New York. When we come back, history is being made in Mexico. Whoever wins of the top two candidates, it will lead to a woman president. We'll speak with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Maria Hinojosa, who interviewed both of them, back in a minute.
Sigo sacando espinas de lo profundo del corazón. En la noche sigo encendiendo sueños para limpiar con el humo sagrado cada recuerdo. Cuando escriba tu nombre en la arena blanca con fondo azul, cuando mire cielo en la forma cruel de una nube gris, aparezcas tú. Una tarde subo una alta loma, mire el pasado, sabrás que no te he olvidado.
Hasta la Raíz, To the Root, Radical, by Natalia Lafourcade. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to Mexico, where this Sunday millions of voters are poised to elect the first woman president in Mexico's history. The landmark moment has filled many with hope, as Mexico has one of the highest rates of gender violence and femicide in Latin America, with at least 10 women murdered in Mexico every single day. Voters will be choosing between frontrunners Claudia Sheinbaum and Xochitl Gálvez, third candidate Jorge Álvarez Méndez. Sheinbaum has maintained a significant lead in the polls ahead of June 2nd elections. She is the former mayor of Mexico City, member of the ruling left Morena Party, seen as a continuation of the current president, AMLO, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, while Gálvez, a former senator, is backed by a coalition that includes the conservative PRI and PAN parties. The PRI, or Institutional Revolutionary Party, ruled Mexico uninterrupted for 71 years until the 2000s. Rampant violence, perpetuated in part by the decades-long U.S.-backed so-called war on drugs, is a central issue. This campaign cycle has been one of the deadliest in Mexico, with at least 34 candidates or aspiring candidates assassinated since September. Immigration and Mexico-U.S. relations are also pivotal issues. In a minute, we'll be joined by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Maria Hinojosa to discuss the historic elections. But first, let's turn to clips of Maria's recent interviews with both front runners, Sheinbaum and Gálvez, which recently aired on Latino USA. Maria Hinojosa and her colleague, Penelope Ramirez, were in Mexico City earlier this year, where they spoke to Claudia Sheinbaum at a campaign rally. They asked her how she'd handle immigration.
What is your message to Latino Mexican voters in the United States about this election and your candidacy?
We're going to fight for them, for their rights, and we're going to fight for the families in Mexico. We want welfare for all the Mexicans.
Now you have said a few days ago that Biden and Trump should stop talking about the Mexican elections. Why you said that, and what's your plan regarding immigration?
The best way to reduce migration is to invest in the countries where people have to live and want to go to the U.S., either if Biden wins or Trump wins. There are a lot of problems in the U.S., and it's better that their campaign not use Mexico as the problem. We are not the problem. We are part of the solution.
They met Xochitl Gálvez while the presidential candidate traveled to New York to meet with Mexican voters here. This is what Gálvez said.
So what is your fresh, new approach towards the issue of immigration?
Primero, entender que el fenómeno de la migración es un fenómeno mundial.
Now, she did not really answer the question, but she did say to us that we needed to understand that immigration is a worldwide problem, and therefore the solution, she said, was to sit and talk.
Entonces, no nos sentemos, no hablemos, no hagamos cooperación profunda, y se van a seguir muriendo jóvenes en este país.
She replied that if we don't sit and have a dialogue, young people will keep dying on both sides of the border.
Xochitl Gálvez, the other Mexican presidential candidate. For more, we are joined by Maria Hinojosa, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and founder of Futuro Media, host of Latino USA, which has just released its new episode titled A Presidenta Will Lead Femicide-Plagued Mexico. Maria, it's great to have you with us at the table. Why don't you start off by talking about the historic significance of these elections and what it means for what's happening in Mexico today?
You know what's interesting, Amy, because you and I have been doing this for a while, right? The reason why two women end up being the two frontrunner candidates is not just like, oh, it just happened. There was a tremendous decades-long work by feminists in Mexico, along with feminists all over Latin America, pushing for equality, pushing for equity for women. In the face of violence, in the face of impunity, the feminist movement in Mexico and Latin America just kept on pushing to the point where you were able to make it by law that there had to be parity in the government. And this leads to both women ending up as candidates. And it is historic. You know, I'm asking the question. It's a little, but Which country is more machista? The United States, that has two old men, one accused of strange and weird sexual...